Welcome, doodlers, multimediaists, ledge walkers, and form jumpers to another episode of Right Minded, where we are often exploring creativity and process and how writers come to the page. And today we have the great privilege to discuss a topic that's new to us and growing in popularity, it seems, with each passing publishing season, and that is the art of graphic stories, novels, and memoirs with our guest, Mira Jacob. So Grant, beyond getting to talk to Mira today, which is exciting, I'm wondering about your own experience with graphic books. Do you read them? Do your kids read them? Do NaNoWriMo participants dare to try to work on them in November?
Yeah, I think yes to all the above. I love graphic books. Some of my favorite novels and memoirs are graphic books such as Persepolis and Art Spellman's Mouse. And then I received a few years ago Logic Comics for Christmas, and it was a cool way to learn. It's all about Bertrand Russell and this foundational quest of mathematics and philosophy, and it's told in all this, you know, wonderful dramatic graphical context that makes it really accessible and engaging. And my kids have been huge fans of graphic books. They've read so many over the years, everything from Captain Underpants to the Big Nate books and beyond. And my daughter just read this really great one called Hey Kiddo by Jarrett. I'm not sure if I'm going to pronounce his last name right, but it's Kroziska. And it's about his life growing up with a missing father and a mother who was an addict. And I'm going to read it after Simone's done. And what's interesting about this is it's a really harrowing read, but that's one of the things I love about graphic books. They can make serious subjects more accessible in an interesting and engaging way. And I really hate it when I hear graphic novels referred to in disparaging terms, because especially as kids, you know, get older and people think they're supposed to grow out of them, because I feel like the experience of reading a graphic book is as deep and meaningful as reading text. And in fact, I don't know why more stories actually aren't accompanied by images. And then with NaNoWriMo, I hear about more and more NaNoWriMo writers writing graphic novels or converting their text-only novels into graphic form, which is also super cool. How about you, Brooke? Have you read many graphic memoirs?
Yeah, I read, well, not many. I read Alison Bechdel's Fun Home, and that was the first time I'd ever heard of graphic memoir. And it was published in 2006, and I was just a couple years into my job at Seal Press. And I remember that it felt quite groundbreaking at the time and also strange, this notion that a memoir could be illustrated. Then it went on to become a New York Times bestseller. And I think in a lot of ways that lended legitimacy to the form. I also hate that graphic novels and memoirs are getting disparaged. I mean, we've talked about this where other genres are concerned, fantasy, sci-fi, romance. Honestly, a lot of genre fiction gets disparaged by quote unquote real literature. And it's such a snobbish way to approach any literary form because readers have all kinds of different tastes. And Mira's book, Good Talk, will help readers see just how deep these stories can go. And I'd argue even deeper than the narrative form for a lot of reasons. You know, and for James, my son, who's 9 years old, you know, he's reading mostly graphic books right now. And I was thinking about a conversation we had a while back, Grant, about one of your son's teachers who wanted him to read less sci-fi and fantasy. And you were kind of like, I'm cool with whatever he wants to read. And that's exactly what I'm experiencing now, because James's teacher wrote in his report card that she wants him to read more real life fiction and fewer graphic novels. I get where it's coming from, especially as a teacher. You know, I love her. And so it's not like an indictment on her as a teacher. But if you have a reluctant reader, then any kind of reading is a coup. And so I think we're seeing the graphic novel, though, and the memoir as well, as emerging as its own form, separate and more elevated, certainly from its roots as just an offshoot of the comic book. What's your experience of that, Grant?
Yeah, just if I can pause, just to relate an anecdote to James's teacher and Jules's teacher back when he was, steered or guided towards supposedly more serious literature. Jules just turned to me the other day, and he actually reads a bunch of different sophisticated novels and nonfiction books. He's 18 now, but he just turned to me the other day because he was reading Ocean Vuong's On Earth Were Briefly Gorgeous, which is a very sophisticated book, and it's written by a poet. And he was telling me how much he enjoyed reading it because it was written by a poet. So, you know, he's still reading sci-fi, fantasy, and graphic novels. Loving it all. It's all good. They all go together.
Totally.
So anyway, looping back to your question, though, I think graphic novel is really, really blossomed in interesting ways in the last 30 years or so. Although one could make the point that its heyday was in the age of cave paintings, I think. That's how stories started, was through images. We think through images just as much as we think through words. So it's nice to see the advent of the graphic book, you know, really since the 70s and or the 80s and 90s is how I think of it. And that's when I think the growth of manga novels, for instance, really became mainstream. And then Mouse, the memoir I mentioned earlier, which is the biographical story of Art Spiegelman's parents in World War II during the Holocaust. And it actually received a special Pulitzer Prize in 1992. And there are just so many great ones to name. Neil Gaiman's Sandman series and Watchmen, which was just made into a great series on HBO. And so many of them have become movies. In fact, two of my favorites come from the underground comic scene are Dan Klaus's Ghost World and Harvey Pekar's American Splendor. And many of these I just listed border the memoir category. And that's one thing that's interesting to me about graphic books is that the lines of the categories blur for me. I can go from Watchmen to Mouse to Ghost World, and I don't care so much what category they're located in the store. They're all just graphical stories to me. But to talk about memoir more specifically, Brooke, is graphic memoir booming in the same way memoir has been booming in general?
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up those older, you know, comic series and other things and talked about the 1990s, because it made me remember, of course, about the girl zines, you know, which were hugely popular in the 90s. And I think probably in a lot of ways were an outlet for feminist writers and younger girls. And when I mean teenagers and girls in their 20s and stuff who were just writing really edgy stuff on the page. And so I do think the memoir stuff is an offshoot of that. And it is absolutely on the rise. I mean, I spend a lot of time in bookstores, and particularly these days, a lot of times in the kids section. And so the number of graphic memoirs for kids has skyrocketed. And James is reading a series by Raina Telgemeier, whose graphic memoirs are Smile, Sisters, and Guts. So three books. And prior to writing graphic memoirs, she'd written a bunch of graphic novels. So it was fun to me to see that she'd gained enough popularity to write some memoirs for kids. And Mira speaks about this in our interview, you know, how the drawings can support a connection to the content in a way that words alone can't, especially when people are maybe sick of having certain conversations or the conversations are hard. And she wrote, or drew, as we might say, her graphic memoir, Good Talk, because it was an easier point of access she imagined for her readers. I think that absolutely turns out to be true. You know, the intensity of the subject matter is somewhat mitigated by the visual elements. And so the book has a lot of humor, of course, but also a lot of really tough stuff, including graphic content. And you know, I think that that's the reason that graphic memoirs are surging for kids, because kids are wanting to digest that kind of tough content, and it can be absolutely more accessible if it's in a form like this. And there are lots and lots of graphic memoirs about gender and sexual identity, and a lot about race and ethnicity. You mentioned Persepolis by Marjane Satrapi. She is a French-born Iranian author of two books by the same title, one from 2000 and one from 2004. And those books have actually been censored in some places here in the States due to the graphic language and images. And so it's clearly a popular medium, too, for edgy and raw material.
Yeah, that's for sure. And I appreciate how Mira speaks about her own urgency to get this story out, and how, as such, it wasn't going to be this refined thing, you know, that's compared to, you know, just comparing it to someone like Alison Bechdel, who took 7 years to draw Fun Home. So I hope our listeners will go and look up Mira's book online as well and see her treatment of the illustrations and her images, because it's truly multimedia with Sharpie illustrations and family photographs and maps of Brooklyn and popular culture images like the album cover of Michael Jackson's Thriller. She just makes so much use of so many different kinds of visuals, and it's exciting and edgy and funny and raw. And it's a real tour de force. And I'm looking forward to talking to her today about her inspiration and process.
Me too. Let's do that. And in the meantime, we'll be back in far less time than it takes you to listen to Thriller all the way through. It's close to midnight, and something evil's lurking in the dark. So, Grant, do you remember that lunch we had back in 2018 when we first talked about the idea of doing this podcast together?
I do. It was at a restaurant called Zoot in Berkeley, and I had a mushroom pizza. And when you asked me if I wanted to do a podcast, I said, sure thing. And then on the way home, I thought, wait a minute, I don't know the first thing about podcasting.
Yeah, I can imagine how much less trepidation we would have had if we had a resource that helped us every single step of the way.
Yeah, for sure. I know I was thinking, I'd love to do a podcast with you, but I just couldn't add any more work to my plate.
Right. And that worked out really well for us, didn't it?
Yeah, I'm not going to lie to people. Doing a podcast can be a bit time consuming, but StartaPod would have been a lifesaver with all that they offer. I mean, just to list a few of their tools, they have in-depth video courses on their site. They offer discounted hosting and easy to purchase gear. And they just provide this exclusive pathway with access to potential ad revenue, too, which is crucial if you want to monetize your podcast.
That's right. And that's why we want all of you to know about StartaPod. It is an all-in-one resource for starting a podcast from the ground up. And they're really good folks over there at StartaPod who want you to succeed. Because if it's not working for you, you can cancel at any time.
Yeah, StartaPod has everything you need for a podcast, except listeners, and they help you get them. So I highly recommend that people take advantage of StartaPod.
Me too. And you can right now because they're offering our listeners who sign up for StartaPod 50% off the first year of your monthly or annual subscription. But in order to do that grant, they need the URL. So will you do the honors?
Yes. StartaPod.com/right-minded. And right-minded is just one word, no hyphen. StartaPod.com/right-minded.
And let me just break down that offer one more time. Sign up today. Get 50% off at startapod.com/right-minded.
It's not stopapod.com. It's startapod.com/right-minded. So get started.
Welcome back, everybody. We have Mira Jacob with us today. And Mira is a novelist, memoirist, illustrator, and cultural critic. Her graphic memoir, Good Talk, A Memoir in Conversations, was shortlisted for the National Book Critics Circle Award, longlisted for the Penn Open Book Award, and named a New York Times notable book, as well as a best book of the year by Time, Esquire, Publishers Weekly, and Library Journal. It is currently in development as a television series with Film 44, and her work has appeared in all kinds of other places, New York Times Book Review, Electric Literature, Tin House, Literary Hub, and elsewhere. She is currently the visiting professor at the MFA Creative Writing Program at the New School and a founding faculty member of the MFA program at Randolph College. And she is also the author of the novel, The Sleepwalker's Guide to Dancing, and she lives in Brooklyn with her husband and son. Welcome, Mira. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
In an interview on Electric Lit, you talked about your process with this book. You said that Good Talk was different from your other writing and that your process was, and I'm going to quote you here, to get it all down, to get it drawn, and don't make it into something unspeakably beautiful and refined. Can you speak both to your inspiration to write this book, which seems to have stemmed at least initially from your son's obsession with Michael Jackson, and also how you stayed disciplined enough to keep it raw and not need it to be more refined?
Yeah. So that's, you know, what's really interesting about that idea is I think because I'm a writer and I'm used to not just crafting sentences, but stepping away from them and sort of taking the emotional beat to say, how true is this? How real is this? And then you sort of refine a sentence both for aesthetics and for the emotional truth. Because I was new to drawing with this book, meaning I draw on my own, but I'd never drawn a book before, because I was new to that part of the process, I think I understood right away that if I was going to try to do it perfectly, i.e., make a book that, you know, an illustrator who had been illustrating for 20 years was going to make, it was going to take me 20 years to make it. You can't just learn that level of craft overnight. And what I figured out really early on was, that's okay, that's not your mission this time. Your mission is to draw this the way that you know how and let it fall out of you in a way that is sort of urgent and present and tells the story as it is. And if I had something that I was really holding myself to, which is usually, just to go back to that example, as a writer, it would be like, you know, is the rhythm right? Is it kind of crafted well? Is it landing the right way? This time, my question for myself was, are you writing the truth of this moment? And are you writing it for clarity or vindication? And if you're writing it for vindication, you have to cut it. And if you're writing it for clarity, you get to keep it. And that was the aesthetic that was really, that I was kind of drilling me forward in the book. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I love that. That's such a nice and important measure, I think, for any memoirist especially. So thank you.
Yeah, definitely. That's really interesting. And I know, Mira, that your first book was actually a novel, The Sleepwalker's Guide to Dancing, which makes me curious about what drew you to write this book, not just as a memoir, but as a graphic memoir. And can you tell us a little bit more about your background as an illustrator or artist before you drew this book?
Yeah, absolutely. My background as an artist and illustrator was a person who had a journal with blank pages that I would draw on when I was stressed out. So I didn't have sort of deep understanding of the many things that I would figure out by the time I was done drawing this book, which is, you know, it's kind of boring stuff from like four different kinds of software and how to use things like InDesign to how to hold a stylus so that when your wrist hits the screen, because when you draw on a screen, it's really different than drawing on paper, you don't mess up your entire drawing. So there were a bunch of things I had to learn in order to do this technically. But the reason that I did that and the reason that I approached it that way is because normally what I would do with a book like this is write an essay, right? You have... you're in a moment in America, just to give a little context to what this was my son is, you know, I'm brown, my husband's white, my son lands between us. We're in a heavy political moment in America leading up to the 2016 race. My in-laws become avid Trump supporters. And rather than trying to write the essay of what was happening to us as a family, what I decided to do was write all the conversations that were happening both in that moment and outside of that moment that had kind of led to that moment, the perfect storm of identity in a way, if you could just have it come to you through the lens of conversations. So one of the reasons that I took this specific approach in drawing it is because I realized that when I would write it in terms of an essay, people would just latch on to all the things that I'm used to of thinking of like bridges between myself and other people, all the words, all the ways I could contextualize something. And they would tell me either it didn't happen or it was a lie or I was, you know, overstating it. And I kind of had a moment where I was like, what if they just have to read the conversation? What if I don't contextualize it? What if I don't try to explain it? And the minute I did that, I settled down on this format, which is basically using my son and I or myself and many other people in my life as kind of paper dolls and just letting the conversation play out page after page after page. And so in doing that, it was actually really interesting because once I did that, I got out of the sort of, I guess the easiest way to say this is I got out of the conversation with all the people that I would know didn't want to believe me, and I could just have the conversation itself speak for itself.
Well, thanks for speaking to that thing with memoir where people are like, that can't be true when it's your own experience. Because I teach memoir and I find that happening. But I also find that increasingly more students I'm working with are not writing from a place of distance, you know, and they're writing about the things that they're living through right now. And you shared in an interview I read someplace that you had an instructor who told you that you should have distance from something before you can write about it objectively. And your response was like, that was just not an option for you. So I was wondering if you could unpack that for us a little bit and also say what positives you think come out of not having distance from the project you're working on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's such a good question. And I also teach memoir, and I also have a lot of students that really are coming from that place of I'm in the middle of something and I'm experiencing it. And I am telling, and I will tell you, both as a fiction writer and an essay writer, I think there was some point at which when I was writing this and I realized that I was right in the middle of this thing and it was going to be really painful to try to write the truth of it, not to mention tricky, you know, like how do you not just constantly defend yourself? How do you not just come down on your own side? How do you sort of intellectually, rigorously question where you're coming from in the same moment when you feel like all you want to do is have your own back? So the line between clarity and vindication became really, really important to me. Like I would write everything. This book that I have is a collection, I think, of about 40 something conversations. I wrote 80 something. And what I did was I would write them and then I would sit with them afterward. And every time I was like, did you write this one just to get your point across, just to like to win this one, just so people would understand how right you are in this moment? If that's true, you've got to let go of it. You can't write from that place. That place is less important than What happened? What was the truth of this conversation? What about it was confusing? Because I actually feel like so many of the things that have happened in my life, if I'm solid on a fact that I've been wronged in something, then in fact, I don't really need to express it to other people except to kind of collect the token of their agreement with me and move on. The things I'm more haunted by, and the thing that's really this central to this book, is like this idea of how can somebody both say they love me and be racist? How can that be true? And yet it has been nothing but true in my life. And it's really hard when you're raised in an America where people permanently put that idea as like, well, love is the end of racism. And if somebody loves you, then that means that they can't be racist and all the beige babies are going to fix the world. And if you've been raised on that kind of a myth, then unpacking that and sitting with it and saying, okay, which thing is this? And how do these things work together? And then how do I not answer this with my need for vindication? How do I answer this with my curiosity? I feel like if you gun toward the curiosity, you get to the more interesting work and you get to the place where most of us live, which is not in this feeling of I'm absolutely right about this and I deserve for you to kind of be on my side, but I'm deeply uneasy about this. I don't know what to make of it. I don't know how I'm going to grow around it. I don't know how I'm going to be whole again.
That's such an interesting premise to follow in one's writing. So thanks for sharing that, Mira. You know, when I was reading your book, I thought your conversations with your son were just so poignant and often so funny. And of course, it made me think back to my conversations that I've had with my kids when they were young. And I especially loved one panel where you show a knock-knock joke and you're pressing on something and it goes, knock, knock. Who's there? Canoe, canoe who? Canoe not talk about this anymore. And made me laugh. I'm going to use that more in my life, I think. It made me laugh, of course, but it's also a bit heartbreaking because it made me, you know, think of kids' curiosity, but also how kids get overwhelmed. And so I was wondering if you could talk about this experience with your son and how you showed up for him, both in the moments when he pressed you and you didn't want to talk about certain things anymore, and where you pressed him and he didn't want to talk about things anymore.
Yes, I'm so glad you bring this up. I have to say, because one of the things that happens a lot when I'm talking about this book is I think people want to repackage it as like a parenting advice book. Like, here's a person who's like got a kid and she has a lot about parenting, so she's got advice. And I always feel like, I think if the book says anything, it's that not that great at it. I'm not that great at it, guys.
None of us are.
Like, these conversations are pretty overwhelming. I feel like I'm a little bit out of my league in them. But the way, and I feel like you're asking me the exact right question, which is how do you show up for it? This is what I ended up doing as kind of a strategy with my kid while all of this stuff was going on. And while, while we were kind of in a situation where the world was getting more and more hostile toward us. And yet people in his life that love him and love me and love us, we're still sort of maintaining, you know, we love you. And it's confusing. It was confusing for me. It was confusing for him. But what I ended up kind of calling on the line on that was, I cannot answer questions he's not asking me. So like with something like racism, if your kid asks you, are white people afraid of brown people, which is something he asked me early on, I can just tell you that my head in that moment spun to so many things I wanted to tell him. Like 27 years of having like thought through it, and then another 20 years on top of that of living with the rage of having thought through it. And, you know, like all of these things wanted to pop out of my brain. But I remember being like, he's not asking that. He's asking you one question. How do you answer that one question honestly, but also not layering on all of your fears to it? So what I ended up saying in that moment was sometimes, just really complicated, right? You don't want to tell that to a six-year-old kid. Are white people afraid of brown people? Sometimes. But that was actually, I also think, the right answer for the moment. Because I was telling him the truth, and I also wasn't telling him every other fear I have and live with, both for myself and for him, about that fact.
Well, Mira, this book has been so well received, and having read it, I certainly understand why. And you already spoke to a little bit about, you know, what might have happened if you had written it in narrative form and why this couldn't be that. So my original question was simply, do you think the book would have been so well received if it had been a narrative memoir? But I kind of want to turn that on its head a little bit and just say, why do you think this multimedia format has landed so well with readers?
I mean, one thing, it's a really interesting question because I can tell you, I feel for me, it sort of splits up into two things. One is what kind of creative self could I bring to that? So let's get back to that. But the other is just the packaging, which is, I think it's kind of hard to look away from a conversation, right? It's kind of like when you're reading in dialogue bubbles, when you're reading what basically looks like a cartoon, I think it's very digestible in that you are, as the viewer, you're kind of eavesdropping on a conversation. And because you're eavesdropping on this conversation, it's not pointed at you. Like, you are not indicted in that conversation immediately. So I think there's part of that that happens for the reader where they listen to it, they read it, and it sort of plays over in their head. And then they think in kind of the after moments, what level of complicity they do or don't have with those moments in their own lives. And so I think there's a kind of refraction that happens there, a sort of emotional refraction that's really helpful. I can also tell you, though, as a creative person, because you're somebody who teaches memoir, the thing that it did for me, which I think shows up in the page, and I think people can kind of dial into that a little bit, is that I was not emotionally exhausted writing this book because I wasn't trying to explain it to people that had zero interest in listening to me. And the way I kept myself from trying to do that was to not build elaborate sentences justifying my reactions. It should just put it down and sort of believe that the people who wanted to get it would get it and the people that didn't would walk away. And that was really helpful. And I think some part of that, if I'm talking about the emotional refraction that the reader can get, that for me was really important to me as a creator, to live in a place where I could do that and not burn myself out and not kind of have to mind myself in a way that's a little bit sacrificial. I think America has a big appetite for racial pain. And I think it's really painful to meet that appetite as a creative person. And this helped me do it in a different way. Does that make sense?
Yeah. You know, Mira, when you're talking, I was just thinking about how many layers there are in this book to explore. You know, its form, its structure, its process, and your urgency around getting the book done. And then all the many layers of things you're exploring around race and interracial marriage and being a person of color in Trump's America and growing up as a first generation Indian American and more than that. So I'm just curious because this book has sparked so many different types of conversations and you've done a lot of interviews. So I'm curious, what are the best conversations you're having about the book? And then what are the hardest conversations you're having about the book?
Mm. Wow, that's such a good question. Okay, so I will say, let's go with the hardest first, because the hardest one is really clear to me, which is I thought that the hardest part of writing this book would be the wall of hatred and, you know, death threats and all the rest of things that happen when somebody like me writes a book about race. And to be totally clear, those things happen. People get mad. I have readers that show up and want to kind of correct me in person about my own experience, and that's wild. But that's not the hard part. The hardest part about writing this book for me has been running into the many people that relate to it so deeply. And when they come to my readings, they tell me something really awful that's happened in their lives. And I know that they're telling me because they connect with it. And I know they're also telling me because they're living with this enormous amount of pain. And staying present for that moment is hard. And knowing I can't fix it is hard. That sounds so stupid when I put it that way, but I mean that in a genuine way. It's hard to know that somebody's coming to you with something that's going to be hurting them for a long time. And they're looking for a moment of solace. So that has been the hard part. The interesting conversations actually have been with, because I think so much of the way we talk about race in America is really through the lens of black and white. And the most interesting conversations for me have been coming through all of the many, many, many different kinds of people in America who do not fall strictly on that spectrum, but have always felt like, and therefore have felt that the conversation never includes them. It never includes their complexity. It never includes the fact that, like, they're brown, but their mother's racist. What do they, you know, how do we talk about that? Their brown mother is racist. You know, like, what does that mean? And what does it look like when brown people treat black people badly and brown people treat other brown people badly? And, you know, that conversation to me, which is so much wider and richer and more interesting than just this kind of same old rehashing of the ills of America through the same lens, that has been really fascinating for me. And I've really loved that. There's a chapter in there about colorism specifically, because I was really dark in my family and all my aunties feel terrible about the way I ended up color-wise. And that's a chapter that I have person after person come up to me and say, I'm also the too dark one in my family. But why did you tell people about that? And it's a really complex conversation because they both love the fact that I talked about it. And they're like, why are you giving white people an excuse to be racist? If you tell them that our own people are, you know, colorists, then they're going to feel okay about what they do. And it's a wild conversation, right? It's really interesting to me. And I've really loved that part of it.
Wow. I see a follow-up book here. Thank you for sharing all those. And this is the last question, Mira. Your son is now 10. Is that right?
He's 11 now.
11. Okay. And I have a 9-year-old. And so the reason I asked this question, it has to do with graphic memoirs. My son is reading Raina Telgemeier's series of graphic memoirs.
Oh, yeah.
Which is cool. I'm curious to know your thoughts on graphic memoirs' place in the world of literature right now, especially for kids, and also whether your son read the book and what he thought, your book.
Okay. So I think that I would just say one of the things that I really love about graphic work, whether it's memoir or fiction, graphic literature, is that I think it allows us to feel a different range of emotion in the way that music does and in the way that poetry does. I just feel like on all of those different registers, there are notes that you can hit, there are places, there are ranges that aren't distinctly spelled out for you, but they resonate in your body in a different way. And I love that about graphic work. And for kids in particular, I love that it's kind of easy for them to pay attention when so much of this world fractures their attention. I feel like it's really amazing to me that there's a way in which they kind of get it. You know, it's a little bit like watching a television, except it's much more active and it lives in their brain in a different way. So I love that part of it. And I love that for adults too, frankly. What was the second part of your question? Sorry.
Just the part about whether your son actually read your book and what he thought.
Oh yeah. Okay. So that's a funny story actually. So my son, I had read him the sections that he was in. And he was the only person in the book that I said, you have every right to reject any of this. You don't even have to explain why. If you don't want it in the book, it gets cut. The end. And so I said that to him. And so I read all the sections to him and he was like, great, great, great. You know, and a lot of times I would read it to him and he'd be like, I'm so funny. 'Cause he actually is really funny. and so that was one thing. But then one day we were at my publisher's office and Chris Jackson, my editor, goes, yeah, are you ever going to, you know, have Z read this? And I was like, oh yeah, when he's older. And he was with me and he goes, oh no, yeah, I read the whole thing. And we both went, what? And he goes, yeah, the sex parts, the drug parts. And I was like, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. I know. And I said, oh boy. And I was like, should we talk about that? And he goes, nah, probably not.
Wow. I love it.
We did talk about it. And we specifically talked about what we ended up talking about was the, there's one part in there where I drew myself naked. And I kind of had to explain that to him, like why I did that and what it means to be sex positive when you're in a dark woman's body, and how many times I didn't get anything like that when I was growing up and how ashamed of my body I felt. And I explained all this to him and, you know, and I was like, I just want you to know, it's not just showing myself naked for no, like I'm showing myself naked so that girls who are younger than me, who get all these messages from their family, know that like, no, you have a body, you might like to use it. It's okay. And he goes, okay. So like for feminism, basically.
Like, for feminism.
Yeah, okay, yes, for feminism, basically. And he's like, yeah, I'm cool with it. That's great.
Thank you, Mira, so much. Thanks for your generosity of time, and thank you for writing this book.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
We will be right back with Brooke's Takeaway.
So today's takeaway is to take a stab at a multimedia project. I mean, a book is a huge project, but Mira talked about having 80 different conversations and only 40 of them showed up in her book. And so maybe you want to try something like that, a conversation, maybe just one panel could take just a regular sheet of paper, computer paper, and take inspiration from what she did, you know, cutting out visual images. She had album covers, personal photos, maps, and more. Her layouts are funky and fun. And even if you just tackled this single page or a single spread, it is really interesting to see the ways in which multimedia can inform a story that you're working on and open up unexpected possibilities. So we offer it up. Have fun. One of the things that really struck me about today's interview was how much Mira talked about how the fun that it was for her and the distraction that it was bringing her in a good way. So we hope that maybe this will offer you that as well.
Yeah, thanks, Brooke. And I want to thank Hoosier1966, who wrote this very nice review on the Apple Podcasts. Says, just found a group of writers that are real. You are people talking about writing, not talking down to the audience about writing. I felt like I was sitting in a living room with you. This is exactly the effect we want to create. You're just sitting in the living room with us every week talking about writing. And you can download us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And we will see you next week in this living room.